Cloud. Go ahead, Rick.
Okay, so greetings and welcome to Unraveling the Secrets. I'm Rick Osmond. That guy over there is Chris Finnefrock, and we have a couple very special guests today. And they will be discussing a Chinese connection in, well, relatively ancient times, and how that came about. But first, Mark and Lori Nicholas live in Missouri, and they are acquainted with not only the physical remains of Cahokia, but also some cultural remains that are actually show up in the very Far East. Mark and Lori, welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I have one question. Were you aware that in, I believe it was 1921, the remains of a silkworm pod were discovered at Cahokia?
I believe it's in a museum in Edwardsville. Mm-hmm. And we haven't examined, but I've heard that.
Yes. Yeah, I've heard that too. I haven't been there, but a good friend and a former producer of my old show, Vince Barrows, he was very aware of it. And of course, he's very, very familiar with Cahokia, as you guys are. Another thing that you've discovered, and I'm just going to turn you loose here in a moment, is what you're calling, and not just you, what is called a horse gate that was part of the palisade, I think it was the outer ring palisade at Cahokia. I'm replicating that in my pasture so that I don't have to unhook a gate every time. I just walk through and the horses can't. So let's just start there and tell the folks where you think they got a horse gate in ancient Native American lands.
Are you referring to the gate style where mm-hmm. it hooks like this?
Yes.
Well, I think that's simply a matter of, it's like the murder holes in a medieval castle. It's really easy to control the speed with which somebody comes through and stop them if you don't want them. And yes. So it's just one of those logical things, because you're wanting to control access to an area where your most important people are. It's like having multiple gates to get into the White House or layers of security at Buckingham Palace. You can't just plow straight in. You have to pass through those layers before you get anywhere.
Right.
And it just happened to also work that way well with horses.
Yes, and probably bison as well, although I've never seen anybody deer. Address that question.
Yeah, they had tame deer, so it would have kept those wandering herds out as well.
Yep. So tell us about that far-flung, far eastern connection, if you would, please.
Well, August of 2005, we found a book that mentioned a translation in the early 20th century by Antoine Goodrich of a book called An Account of the Western World Voyages of the Sanbao Eunuch. And it looked like the kind of scrambled craziness you find today if you try to just straight Google translate something. So we thought, hey, you know, maybe she just didn't have enough dictionaries. And so we sent word around, we had some contacts here and there, and we got a hold of the book and we started digging. The scene that was in the book that Swan Goodrich had translated sounded to me like somebody was trying to describe, I use the word a powwow. It wasn't exactly a powwow, but it was, there were things that knowing how crazy a bad translation can get caught my attention. And I said, we have to either prove it's true or prove it's not true, because this is too big a nugget to ignore. We have to find out if it's real gold or fool's gold. And so we chased it from there. And this book was in Chinese. It had never been a strong, solid modern translation made of it. And it purported to be what happened beyond the recognized end of the last voyage of the Ming treasure fleet, number 7, by the San Bao, which is corrupted into Sinbad in most Western literature. And we're impertinent enough to say, well, what does it really say? Yeah. And everybody else took it as a fairy tale. And we said, it's too familiar.
Lori, what's your process of decipherment? You know, how do you explain how you do it?
Well, I always say I try to use scientific method. And by that, I mean, create a process that whoever follows me can look at my notes and see exactly how I got there. So I start with the original text and I put that in my notes. And then I go through and I find as many mechanical translations as I can. These usually help me find things like compound words, figures of speech, and so on, but they're never the final word. And then I go through and I do what I call an opinion dictionary translation, which is the character, the words in pinyin, and then as many different ways to translate it as I can find. And then I line all of those up, you know, clause by clause by clause. And with, I have found descriptions of how the grammar of the time fit together. And I figure out what works. And then I compare it against what we know of written oral tradition, written record, and archaeological record that has survived till now. Put that in my footnotes, and I go from what was originally 10 pages to a chapter to about 500, 600 pages by the time I'm done. But I have something that I said may not be perfect, but the criticism can only improve.
It's sort of like building a Rolls Royce by hand. It just takes a while, but you build each piece separately and it just, but you get a Rolls Royce when you're finished.
Yeah. And like I said, anybody that disagrees with me can point out what spot I may have fumbled in. And instead of it collapsing because I screwed up so bad, it can only improve it.
Agreed.
And I end up.
But with, I don't think there's a lot of improvement required.
Thank you. I end up with about a 150 page, no, about a 75 page chapter with 150 footnotes per chapter when I'm done.
Wow.
Yeah, if I don't have a migraine, I haven't worked that day.
Well, Hua Wei Li, retired from the Library of Congress Asian Division, you know, looked at her work, carefully studied it. The key word he used was amazed. He said he was amazed at how good it was and how somebody who wasn't Chinese could do such an incredible job of translation. But part of the secret of the translation, she's hinted at it, was that you have to be at this end of the voyage and know something about Native American and Cahokian and Mississippian culture in order for it to make sense. So there's these things that the Chinese would not understand, which make perfect sense if you know something about Mississippian culture.
I also
right. So they were describing.
Yeah.
Sorry, they were describing also, what they saw.
I also say right? I have one thing in my favor that a lot of people don't. I know I don't know everything, and yeah, when you well, know you don't know everything, you have room to learn more.
That's an exceptional thing in academia.
Yeah.
So the Chinese text, and we're talking something that was, what, 600 years ago?
1587 was when it was written. And it was written about events in 1433,
34, 35. So, yeah, basically 550, 600 years ago, they were describing what they saw, and you have discerned that what they saw took place in Cahokia.
Yeah, well, this was a man interpreting what he found in logs and diaries and so forth that had been sealed away for 150 years, and he had no direct witnesses to talk to clarify, and he was just interpreting it as best he could from what they told him, and he had no frame of reference to explain it with, because it would be a 100 years or two before even European settlers and explorers would reach the area. So
right
there, and everybody there was dead, so there was nobody to explain it. So the illustrations have come out pretty freaky.
I bet. I know that you made a couple trips to China. Could you describe where and what happened?
Start it up. Okay, our first trip was July 2005 in Nanjing, where I read a paper. It was a very strange situation, but I'd done a short article for a hunting fishing magazine out of St. Louis, Outdoor Guide Magazine. Did a 500-word article on why I thought the Piasaw dragon painting described by Marquette in 1673 was actually Chinese. People can look that up on the internet, Piasaw. Okay. And that led to a call out of the blue from a student at WashU, who was China, was William Wu. He said, hey, they're going to do a 600th anniversary commemoration of the launching of the Chinese fleet in 1405. Why don't you take that short article and turn it into a full paper? And that's just crazy. I'm just sitting here painting on the computer right here, and I get this phone call, and why don't you write a paper and come to Nanjing? But that was just so far out, so crazy, we just went with it. Okay, and it ultimately, it culminated in sitting there in Nanjing, and I was utterly exhausted. We didn't know what was going on. Anyway, I read the whole paper straight because I was too tired to be silly. And apparently it went over very well, because ever since then we've had respect, and we've had people, you know, giving us opportunities to speak. But we pretty well laid it out that the Piasaw, and then while we were there, it turned out that we discovered a stone memorial to the Chinese fleet in Nanjing at the boatyards, and lo and behold, it's the same thing as the two pictures we have of the Piasaw by early American artists, down to some of the fine details. And you realize it's exactly the same thing.
We can send you these photos and our illustrations. I actually have a short video that just shows, starting with the Henry Lewis, and another illustration shows the Nanjing memorial marker stele. And it's capstone and fades right through to what I've assembled of the pieces of the Piasaw to what it appears from the remaining evidence in the Lewis illustration, which you can cross-reference against the Caspar Wilde illustration, and you go, okay, that's it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Rick, we've got a lot of the evidence for the Piasaw in Chasing Dragons, the expanded version. Mm-hmm. Okay, people should be looking at that book. And it's already out of date. I have found more information since then.
Yeah. And here is my translation that describes it being built. And I'm reaching for something else here.
Okay.
But you keep talking.
I got it. Okay, where were we? Okay, like I said, this is the expanded version. Since then, I've been doing more research and found several interesting things, including a description, or it was just a few months before Lewis and Clark, by a guy named Ash from Ireland. And he wrote that it was a travelogue, and he wrote that he had found some materials in a mound up the Ohio River that he believed were Chinese, and there was some kind of interlocking metal ring or something like that that he thought was Chinese. He said there was some kind of characters on it that he couldn't read and all that. But then he made a very interesting comment. He said it was, I think he was back in St. Louis at the time, which is near where the Piasaw was. He said it was just commonly assumed that the Chinese had been here. It's just like everybody knew it. But a few months later, Lewis and Clark camped near the Piesaw site before they went up the Missouri River. And there's no record. There's nothing in their logbook for the days they were there. They couldn't have possibly have missed it because they recorded everything else.
They would have had to walk around like this the entire time.
Yeah. But then they ran, you know, what they did then, they went up the Missouri River exploring. One of their major goals was to find the water route to China so that America would get rich on the fur trade. They believed that the Chinese, you could get to China through the Missouri River. And then they found out you couldn't. And then all of a sudden, nobody ever talked about the Chinese being here. I don't know. There's something happened in Lewis and Clark, but before Lewis and Clark, people commonly believed that the Chinese had visited the Mississippi Valley. And of course, there were some reasons for that. And after Lewis and Clark, nobody ever said anything. But then, of course, after Lewis and Clark, we were claiming all that territory in the western part of the United States.
It was divine providence that we should subdue the howling wilderness and elevate
manifest the savages. Destiny. Yeah. Well, a little bit on the Lewis and Clark presence there. At the time, Lewis was actually in St. Louis, and William Clark was in St. Charles, and for almost 3 weeks. Lewis spent 3 weeks in St. Louis signing the treaty and purchase of the Louisiana Territory. And during that 3 weeks, Clark was in St. Charles visiting with Daniel Boone. So they probably did not go up to Alton. They just took off on the Missouri River.
Well, they were camped out.
You had to sail past it to get to the confluence.
You had some hunting trips. They were camped out near Wood River. And they went all up and down the river hunting for deer and elk while they were passing time in the winter. But the point is, the military commander of St. Louis was a guy named Amos Stoddard. And he knew all about the Piesaw and spoke about it later. And
so did Boone.
They knew nothing about it. And they sat there with this man for months. It's not possible.
He would have shown them the more interesting sites. And I don't see how that was something worth missing.
Well, yeah, they also went past Hanging Rock on the Ohio and didn't mention it at all. So,
yeah.
There's a lot of things they conveniently did not see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If anything that contradicted the will of the divine for them to take it all.
Jefferson, in his letter to Lewis, in the orders he gave Lewis about the expedition, he said, if you find anything that could threaten the sovereignty of the United States, you should send it by secret cipher by any means possible.
Well, then that's how he reported it, not in the open records.
Correct. It was not in the ledger. But yeah, I wrote several chapters about that. The whole coding cipher thing is what you're doing. You're deciphering an ancient document. And that's pretty much what we've all been doing to one degree or another. So you found evidence that the Chinese were in Cahokia for some period of time, and that they may have actually caused an epidemic.
It's not a may have. At chapter one onward, there's discussions of how best to neutralize the influence of those demonic pagan leaders, both religious and political, in the area so they stop eating each other. And their feeling was that they had a contagion that would cause an uproar, but not be too much. And this gets into the science. They started talking about heavenly flowers. We must give them the gift of the heavenly flowers, which sounds almost girly. It sounds so innocuous, and it's not. With type A blood type, which is almost universally China and Asia, you have a 30% fatality rate pretty much at worst for, you know, the general run-of-the-mill heavenly flowers. The problem is heavenly flowers don't bloom in your garden. They bloom on your arms, your legs, your face. It's smallpox. Typo, which is almost uniformly all Native Americans, has a 96% fatality rate for smallpox. They over-succeeded. They also had an eruption of the worst form of smallpox, which they couldn't have predicted, which is 100% fatal, which is black pox, i.e. hemorrhagic or unerupted smallpox, where basically you have eruptions under the surface of the skin, your face, your arms, your legs turn black from the coagulated blood, and then all your skin falls off and you die. And this would have happened within a week or two. And the Chinese realized that they had genocidally, preemptively destroyed an entire civilization. And this broke all the rules. This broke the rules to the point that you, if you were the leadership, you lost the mandate of heaven to lead. So instead of disenfranchising the local leadership, they had basically given themselves the pink slip for leading China. And so they went home and they said, okay, well, how do we handle this? We'll burn all the records, we'll burn all the ships, even the ones that we're still building, and we'll seal everything away for 150 years. And by then, it won't matter to anybody anymore. And we'll still be in power. Mm-hmm. Yay! So 150 years later, along comes Luo Maodong, and they had just opened up the archives, and he found all this juicy stuff and started publishing the book I'm translating. And it was still so radioactive that he didn't tell the exact places where it was. You were talking about secret ciphers. If you read the images in the poetry that opens every chapter, you get dates and locations by celestial navigation and the Chinese calendar, cycle of 60. You can figure out exactly where they were from the poetry. And that freaked me out.
Okay.
They were certainly clever. Okay.
Thank you.
A comment on the plague, smallpox epidemic. There's this mystery, and it's in American history. The archaeologists talk about it a lot.
Brackenridge.
The mystery of the vacant or empty quarter, where for some reason the archaeologists say everybody disappeared in the Mississippi and Ohio valleys somewhere around the year 1450. And we're not sure why. Maybe it was warfare. Maybe it was an introduced disease. All we know is that most of the people just suddenly vanished in that area.
It must have been ducks flying over the North Pole to bring a disease. It was the magic ducks of death.
She's not being sarcastic.
I'm sarcastic because the statement, which is in literature, in academia, is so cuckoo that you can't say it straight. You have to make a joke of it because nobody's going to believe you. When you say it the first time, you might as well say it silly.
So yeah, the Mississippian culture just vanished. Now we're saying 1433, 34.
Oh, they got bored. Oh, they got worried because it flooded again, like it does every year. So they wandered off because they got bored. That's also another explanation for the sudden depopulation of Cahokia. Despite the fact that there's a low ridge in this crescent-shaped valley that was the one place you could have walked out of the valley from, and the vast majority of the unburied dead are found at the foot of that area. Brackenridge's accounts are that the locals say that you cannot, that there are areas here, and these are the areas they were talking about, you cannot touch the ground with a spade or a plow without turning up human bone. Literally, too many dead, not enough living to bury them or to even pile them up and burn the bodies. The last
we had similar
Tokyo are chaotic.
You had a similar situation in what they actually called the empty quarter of Illinois, Kentucky, Indiana, where they all come together, where the Wabash yes. flows into the Ohio, or as the ancients said, where the Ohio flows into the Wabash. We had a number of large organized cemeteries there. One is the reason we have Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. And right across the river from that is a place called the Bone Bank. And we have a number of, but these were burials. These were ceremonial burials on the south side of the river. And they were disorganized heaps of bodies in a couple of spots on the north side of the river.
Descriptions of such in Europe would have simply been, oh, it's a plague burial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What date do they give for that?
13 to 1350.
That's a little early.
Yeah, I know.
There's dates for Cahokia all over the place, but the more accurate ones lately, what was it that people kind of, anyway, was in the 1400s, 1430,
1440. Yeah. They've done a Stanol check of where the runoff would have gone. And Stanols are basically chemicals from poop. And there is a sudden precipitous boom. The numbers crash right at the time that what we said happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, complete depopulation.
There was nobody to poop.
Okay.
Yeah.
Literally.
But on the south side of the river, they remained organized for some period of time. And and this is after the 1300 downfall of that part of the Mississippian culture. It doesn't, you know, you got differences of opinion among one state, Illinois, has a much different opinion than Indiana or Kentucky. And yet it was all one culture and it was within sight of each other.
Well,
so if you could see across the river and you could watch everybody die and you don't want to accept any visitors.
Oh, you start shooting flaming arrows and throwing things at them.
Yes.
And they don't land without dying. You just let the water wash them away.
Well, that that gets into an incident she translated toward the end of the book. There was a Mississippian chief to the south of Cahokia. What was it, White Eel?
Yes.
Okay. And the book records that the Chinese are coming down the river and they encounter hundreds of canoes spread across the river. It's basically a line of warriors. And the chief is saying, you know, wherever you guys go, people die. And we don't want anything to do with that. You're going to have to stay out of our territory. And there was a conflict there. But the upshot was they kept the Chinese out of the lower Mississippi River because of this line of warriors that would not let them pass. There's a comment later on, well, we have no tribute from these people because they kind of whipped us. Okay. But the thing is, Mississippian culture survived up to the time of the Spanish in the South, but not in the central area, which is completely consistent with the Chinese account. They had it. They had smallpox in Cahokia. But because these guys in the South knew what was coming, they stopped the Chinese and their culture survived in the South because of that, is what we think.
Well, yeah, and then you had the empty quarter stayed empty. Mm-hmm. But upriver a little ways, at say, for instance, Angel Mounds, they recovered to some degree and they were still active, although it wasn't nearly the same population or
you always recover to a degree.
Yeah, right. And I believe it was active at the time that the Spanish first arrived in North America, De Soto in particular. I believe he came that far north and a little further, actually. But
the story.
There have been just a smattering of reports, not even a real handful, of Chinese origin artifacts at the area around Cahokia on both sides of the river, I might add. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
I'm trying to hear something about artifacts.
Yes.
Okay, well, south of Cahokia, they're a few miles on the main trail between Cahokia and the Iron Mountains in Missouri. there is a Chinese petroglyph that was found and photographed in the 1950s by some archaeologists.
What page that is?
I've got page 60. It's a very small picture we have in the book, but I don't know if you can see that or not.
Yep.
Okay. Yep. These guys that took the photo, the local experts, Frank McGraw and thought it was some kind of European ogham or something. That's kind of a catch-all, ogham and all that. Yeah. But looked at it, I got a picture of it and realized, hey, it's Chinese. Anybody Chinese can read it. It says sharing love or peaceful together in Chinese. And it's right on the main route midway between Cahokia and the Iron Mountains where the Chinese were looking for iron. It's at a location which is, it's a little bluff, but it's almost a natural amphitheater. If there was some kind of ceremony or anything associated with it, you could have sat several hundred people there if you had to.
Yeah. Something else. Okay. I told you that there was a lot of mistranslation or misunderstanding. Well, that encounter with white eel was illustrated in the book looking like this.
Yeah.
And, fish.
But the thing is, I've read the description and I'm working on a piece, and that's a piece of artwork I'm working on. And here's what actually was being described.
Get down a little bit.
Sure.
Quite
fancy. Yeah. But the words at the bottom, I've put in Mayan glyphs, and it says, and war chief White Eel went to this place and tried to be at war with these people, and then he had his head cut off, which is what happened in the book. And I put that in there in Mayan because I just think it was appropriate, because these were a Mayan daughter culture from every description we found.
Okay, you're talking about artifacts. Another one close. Okay, associated with the Piasol painting of dragons, there was, according to the book, one of the engineers who built it, what was his name, Lou, whatever, yes, died, and he was buried in a cave immediately to one side of it. And they painted a red circle, which is protective, over the cave. That incident, that cave, appeared in an American book in the 1850s, okay?
Which we just, oh, yeah.
Okay, anyway, I'm digging around. It's hard to get there very fast. But the point is, okay, it was Records of Ancient Races in the Mississippi Valley by William McAdams, but it described what they called the Piasol Bone Cave. And it was not up high, it was
down on the water level.
It was the picture from the American book, it's an upside down V at
low
level.
A natural fissure in the rock face.
Yeah, with a red circle painted above it. And that's what's in the American account. And that corresponds to the Chinese account. They buried a man in a small cave right next to the Piasol, and they painted a red circle. It had some kind of protective value above it. So that's a Chinese artifact that's right next to the Piasol, the Piasol Bone Cave. From what I've read, there was a human skull found in the cave. So that was probably the engineer. Now, an Indian, in the same picture that shows that, shows a bunch of burial mounds on top of this 100-foot tall bluff or whatever. And the Indians would have,
exactly
there's a better picture somewhere. Indians would have buried their people on top of the bluff. They wouldn't have buried them at river level because their graves would have been washed away. That would have been absurd. So, you know, right from that alone, that it wasn't an Indian burial, because they weren't going to put their people right next to the river where the wind goes up in the spring and the body's gone. You wouldn't do that. Okay. That's it. Oh, there's another one. It might be. Yeah. I don't know. We're still trying to figure this one out. Can you see there's a footprint?
And there's a faint detail of claws there.
Yeah. That's in the museum that's just a few hundred yards from the Piasol site. They don't know what it is.
But they know it's a fragment of the Piasol. And this fragment is about a little larger than waist high on a grown man.
Wow.
So that's a couple of artifacts closed.
Also three. The scroll painting.
Which one is that?
The one that's in the St. Louis Art Museum.
Okay, that's different. Yeah, that's not local. That's a completely different mystery. There is a scroll painting. What did you call it? Panorama.
It's a rolling panorama. So the guy can do a travelogue speaking while he had this two people cranking this thing so that you're going down the Mississippi River. And at one point it shows a head of a huge statue is standing up out of the water. And this head is not native style in any way, shape, or form in anything we have from archaeological evidence of the time period. And then you go even further downriver into what would have been Arkansas, Oklahoma, Texas, okay. And it shows a full body.
This is in Texas.
A full body statue that looks like the Buddha statues from a very famous set of caves in China, including the third eye, the spiritual eye chakra in the middle of the forehead. And the arms are missing, but they're missing right where that typically they would be raised in a Buddha statue, and that naturally breaks off weathering and so forth. You could paste that picture over any of these statues in China or India of a large seated Buddha statue, and it would be an exact match. And people don't talk about those. They just scroll right on past it. But it's sitting right there on the water, right where people would have been sailing by in their canoes, trading, fishing, trapping, going to war.
And there have been several artifacts. What was it? A stone votive sword and some other, some carved jade. That was in the Carolinas or Georgia is where
Georgia, I believe. That votive sword may be the one that's mentioned in the book as something that was used for exorcism by a Taoist religious figure in the story. And he is spoken of receiving it in an early chapter in the book to aid him in removing this taint of demonic worship that was going on in the place which they were going to.
So and in other words, they already...
Demonic. It's pretty
so by that statement, one might assume that before they made that voyage, they already knew what they were going to find.
Well, they had been here in the 1420s. One of the people that they encounter in Cahokia is a Chinese captive of natives who had been taken captive somewhere on the East Coast, where she was stuck because she had some herbal medical training. She was stuck taking care of the sick, and her husband had to go on, and he walks into Cahokia, and there she is. She had been assumed dead, and she basically chews him out and says, I have been waiting for you 11 years, so many months, so many days, and what took you so long? I mean, she reads him the Riot Act. It's straight out of the Honeymooners. I laughed so hard when I found this part, because she was so sassy and so mad, but she had been brought there to feed the gods. And the way they term feed the gods, it's she's not making them lunch, she is lunch. And we know that 25% of all bone trash in Cahokian trash middens is human, with signs of having been subjected to ritual cannibalism. My neighbors, did not play well with it. And my ancestors did not play well with neighbors. If they liked you and said, darling, you're delicious, run.
Yeah.
Because they were serious, take them literally.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, and I won't say it was pervasive among Native American cultures, but it seemed to be fairly common.
Well, being that there was evidence of travel and trade all the way up to Dixon Mounds, up it way north in Illinois of cacao, we're having pan-continental cultural interaction. And in the book, Luo's book, they say, oh, we've been here thus and such number of years. you do the math and it adds up to 865, which is right at the end of the Mayan classical period. And they said, we came here following the hummingbirds. And they winter in Mayan territory and they summer here in North America. And Mark, tell them about two things that match. The two sets of words, the names.
So what is it? You're talking about the Yama?
No, I'm talking about the location names.
Which one is that?
Okay. They called North America Fengdu.
Okay.
But they had a place they called Fengdu La. And where was that, Mark?
Oh, it was in Mayan territory in Guatemala.
Right there on that spot that sticks out at the bottom of Mexico, the Mayan heartland. That's where they had come from.
The Yucatan Peninsula.
That problem. Hold on. The point is, the map you mentioned, okay, it says Fengdu La. It calls Cahokia Fengdu La, or land of that, is in Guatemala on a 1602 Chinese map that was brought to the West by the Jesuit missionary Mateo Ricci. This is the first map Europeans had from China, supposedly. But how did begin with? There's this mystery. I mean, this is all mapped before the Europeans had been to many of these places, but it tied the Cahokia area to Central America, where we know the Mayans came from.
The Mayan mother cities.
That's just incredible.
And the references to dates and times that while they are in Cahokia, the locals mention a date and a time. And the date and time are gibberish unless you compare them to the Mayan calendar. And the local magistrate who says, well, I have to do such and such because it's this day and this time, is using Mayan terms for the date and the time, which basically 9 a.m. on the 20th of the month, it's the day of the day and the hour of the flowers, which is when he had his local claims court.
Just Mayan. So basically the culture is Mayan.
Yeah.
Cahokia, you know, changed from small villages in that into this huge culture with mounds and all that,
and
beginning around the year 900, which is consistent with the Mayans coming.
Again, 865 is right up against that. And common practice is to round to the nearest 50, which would be 50, 55, or 900. And so they rounded to 900, and 865 would have rounded up.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have had a specific number.
So the numeral system, probably some language elements, as well as other cultural elements of classic Maya, have to show up in at least that period of 900 to roughly 1300, 1400 in Mississippian culture.
Yes. And in Luo's book, SLE commented on this, you've done something amazing. You have translated Mayan that was translated into Chinese into English, because he looked at my material and he said, this is, all of these things are Mayan. And he's a incredible, incredible student of history. And he saw it and he just was certain what he was looking at.
So in that period of time, on up into Spanish invasion times, the people of the Yucatan up through central Mexico into the southwestern what is now United States and all the way up to Cahokia consumed a drink that basically was fermented cocoa.
Yes, it was. Little hot peppers, a little spicy, and a little, you know, there was your espresso in the morning.
Bang. Yes, but and it was highly alcoholic.
The leader of Cahokia literally had one of his people talking to him at one point, who was addressed as his keke master, which is cocoa in Chinese. The guy who kept him supplied with his caffeine shot.
His barista.
Yes.
Yes. But this particular drink, according to the analysis of the beakers, also contained a pretty high level of alcohol.
They
may have been as high as 80 proof.
They usually don't mention that because it's a little little less nice.
Corn squeezes.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, it was cocoa. But the other part about that is that the vessels, the ceramic vessels that held these remains, have been found in 36 different locations in North America, stretching all the way to the panhandle of Florida up into Wisconsin, on around. And it all has the same chemical analysis. And even more to the point, all these vessels have the same stylistic pattern or signature, if you will, for the, it was like a branded packaging, like a Coca-Cola bottle or something.
They call them bean pies.
Yeah, pretty much.
Different bean. Our neighbor has one.
Yeah, and the other end of that stick is that it had to have been bottled, if you will, in Central or South America and brought north from there in those containers. So that means it either traveled by land some 2,200, 2,800 miles, depending on which location, or it came up the Mississippi in about, less than 2 weeks.
Well, the thing is, everybody goes Silk Road, Silk Road, Silk Road, and they think camel.
Yeah.
The majority of the Silk Road was through the Indian Ocean and through the South China Sea. So nobody wants to spend the money in man hours or time to haul something that slow. They want to take the fastest, freshest route. So of course, considering that the Maya had these huge Polynesian type giant double-hulled canoes that they were going island hopping through the Caribbean, of course they were going up the Mississippi.
Yeah, I can have
that. Why wouldn't?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was reading about Columbus reported encountering one of these open ocean canoes. It was like 60 foot or whatever. It was longer than his ship.
Yeah.
It was longer than the Santa Maria, his longest ship.
Mm-hmm. Several tons of cargo. And a lot of it was for metalworking, which I thought was interesting. That was more into the South American that we think of as Stone Age people. But they had materials for metalworking on this canoe. But you can imagine a canoe like that going up the Mississippi and holding several tons of chocolate at a time. It'd been worth a fortune.
Yeah.
They were relatively shallow draft, especially when there were multiple hull. So unlike a European ship, which would have dragged bottom like that, our kayak, they would have laughed at it and just sailed on up.
Yeah, pretty much. Their biggest problem would have been snags in the water, but they probably had their routes very well charted out, which brings me to my next question. Okay. So if the Mayan culture evolved into the Mississippian culture at Cahokia, did they bring their writing with them?
Yes.
And what evidence do we have?
You speak to Richard Thornton, and he will tell you that there's a vast number of discounted material out there that are, this pretty design. And he says, no, that's a Mayan glyph. And there is something else that sets my teeth on edge every time I hear it. And you'll understand why it makes me want to scream. But there is stories, and they're out there somewhere, of a huge cache of tablets. It's like at Amarna in Egypt. They found a huge cache of tablets with writing on them. And they said, it's writing. But they found a huge cache like this in the Americas. And they said, it's fake. It's garbage. Throw it away. Somewhere out there in somebody's trash heap, those tablets exist and they're covered with writing. The Chinese say, this and this had signs on it in improper or strange characters we could not read. And it was there. But imagine today, it's anybody who's seen The Day After. Imagine all of your universities, all of your medical centers, all your major population areas gone. All of your guys who were literate and teaching literacy, gone within a week, 2 weeks. And of course, by the time people got here in the northern Mississippi, the upper Mississippi Valley region, of course there was no language because all the centers of learning were gone. And then this is followed by the Spanish in the south, who, that's the work of Satan. We must burn and destroy all of those native texts that we see in the Mayan areas and the Aztec areas. And they went through doing what we call scrubbing, and aggressive scrubbing, of making sure that all of these records were gone. So if there were records that talked about all this stuff.
Yep, pretty much.
It was Satan. It had to be destroyed and disappear.
I can add a little bit to that. In the Cokie area, they didn't use much in the way of stone or, anyway, everything they used was organic, basically wood, skins, and so on.
Or copper,
so
which if would you're, be too valuable to keep behind.
If you're writing, you're going to be writing on skins or some homemade. They did have paper in Central America, some organic material that would not have survived. So it's almost impossible.
Unlike for any Mesopotamia or Egypt, where survive. You have a climate that is very happy to not let things molder, we're damp. Everything was gone.
Yep. Yeah. But you mentioned metal, and there are some metal objects that have.
Mm-hmm. Some copper plates, and they have glyphs on them that would mean something to a Mayan in many cases.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. Mm-hmm. Now, where you were in translating not only Chinese, but also Mayan, and taking multiple notes, I'm sure you came across the idea that context matters in how you translate the same glyph. It may have many different meanings depending on how it's put into the sentence.
Well, there's the stories of the little kid who they said, oh yeah, you go ahead and try doing that. And the kid didn't know he didn't know how. And he figured out that things were done in layers, stacked glyphs. And they were all dumbfounded because the kid didn't know he couldn't. It's like, I don't know I can't, but I know I don't know anything. So I just go for it.
That's why we can.
Yeah, and it was the only thing that worked in any reasonable fashion. It's been refined a little bit since then, but
yes, but he kicked a hole in the door that was locked.
Right. Well, here's a door that might be open one of these days because of that breakthrough. And that is the Quipi. Because my contention is that those knots are read in the same fashion that you read the glyphs. They're in layers.
That's like,
it's kind of, like a binary.
Yes. Well, actually, no, it's got several because of the direction that you tie it, the way you tie it, the color of the thread, a whole bunch of stuff follows in there. But even on top of all that, and that is a deliberate pun, it's in layers.
Yes.
Now, another one, if you will follow me, Lord Pakal's sarcophagus. You know what I'm talking about? The 9-foot-long coffin lid that has the scene of the astronaut, the ancient astronaut guy. This is a spaceship. Yeah, okay, well, let's ignore that part and let's look at what it portrays. It's a guy sitting in a seat of some strange design, and his feet are connected to on something that might be a pedal, and it has some arrows that, not arrows, it has circles that we might interpret as this thing moves in this direction.
It we have might all, have been a, all, some kind of observatory set up.
It may have been exactly that. However, on top of, in the second layer of all this, there's one corner that's broken off of the sarcophagus lid. But what you don't see when you're looking down on this lid is that the outside edge also has glyphs around it. So if you have that corner broken off, and then you think of this as a Mobius strip, then you go around the outside, you come back to this corner, and then you're around the top, and then you come back, and then you're around the, and it's a never-ending story.
That sounds like a calendar.
Layered. Way beyond just a calendar. It's a long-term history, I believe. So anyway, if you want another project, there you go.
Yeah.
Sounds like fun. I wish I had two lives.
Yeah, I understand. But the idea that the poetry portrays one thing that you depicted differently than anybody else had, it's another layer to the story.
Yes.
So that's what I'm saying about the call sarcophagus lid. There are many layers to whatever it actually says. And I don't think it has much to do with a rocket. If anything, he was the Lord of the Underworld. It's a tunneling machine. I'm just telling you.
Well, that's possible because you can do those things with human power, especially if you have the manpower to run on the treadmill.
Yeah, and it's all a matter of how you interpret what you see.
Yeah. Okay. I like yours. That's a fun one.
Yeah. Okay.
Especially since we know they did so much, with their entrances to the underworld of access to their tunneling system. And in Luo, the people of Feng Tu talk about this is the city of the day. And over there on the other side of the river is the city of the night. And we happen to know that St. Louis, most people don't think about it, but there's a vast cave system under there, i.e. entrance to the underworld, city of the night, sure city is. Of the dead.
Yep.
That's why they put the breweries in St. Louis originally. They needed cold storage, and that was the cave system.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So a lot of evidence that might have been there got trampled by
German brewers. Yeah. Okay.
Well, and Clydesdales. But anyway, Chris, did you have something you said? I thought I heard you say something.
Well, I can jump in with a few things. Rick, did you want to take a break for a second?
I need to replenish my coffee cup.
Okay. So we talk about other Chinese evidence that's found in the Americas. I don't know if it seems that the Chinese were more on either the West Coast or, you know, the Southwest or into the Mississippi, but it seems more there rather than perhaps the East Coast, just maybe more there. Is that possible?
I think what it is I have a research assistant who's working on records of visits to the Western regions, which predates this to the 1420s previous voyage cycle that has some mention of people who are clearly native / Mesoamerican. And I have not yet gone completely through Luo. I've been doing a lot of survey lately. And I know that when I went through looking for a particular thing, which was evidence of cacao, keke, I found a description of the American Southwest cities that can only be entered with scaling ladders. And this is, you know, those cliff dwellings, those pueblo dwellings. And I know that there is reference to a landing place where they could refit their ships down in the Caribbean. And all I can say is the Bimini Road may be dry dock because it matches dry docks in the Pacific that were Chinese built, even ones that they're building now.
Okay, you've got a, there's also in the treasure list, there's a list of treasures from an unknown country, and it's distinctly Incan.
Yes.
Very distinctly Incan. It's got to be an Incan treasure.
And there was a disruption at that time period that led to the Inca society structure that we know existed at the time that Pizarro and the conquistadors arrived in Peru, but we're still doing surveys of, like I said, the mechanical, and I'm at the point where I read the mechanical translations and I read the garbage, and I know a lot of the hiccups already, that the mistranslations, I know I've already done them before, so I have more idea. Cannot verify yet because I have not done the dictionary translation or the subjective, which is putting it in English, the final translation on these areas. But I know that the stuff is there.
Okay. Rick, are we about ready to take a break?
Yeah, of course. Let's take a few minutes and then we'll just do, you know, another half an hour. So yeah, let's, I'm going to press pause right now.
Watching him drink all that coffee. No. Here's Laurie.
All right, we're coming back on. Laurie, take your time. So Mark, behind you are so many different books on this topic. I mean, we're talking about all the old Chinese maps. We're talking about John Ruskamp in his Southwest, you know, decipherment of Asiatic symbols and signs. There's, you know, I have a library of 100 different books on Zhonghe and ancient China and seafaring. And I guess that's more of a statement rather than a question. So, you know, I do wonder if you guys have any thought about if those cacao vessels went north, you know, was that their end spot there? Could those vessels have been filled with something else and then returned back south? The reason I suggest that is because the late Tom Anderton of Pennsylvania basically hypothesized with evidence that, what was it, Rick, that the
green crude oil.
So what was the process of that before the crude oil filled the empty vessels?
Oh, well, that crude oil where Tom lived, it just comes up out of the ground. And there are ancient vats, I guess that's the only word I can think of, that they filled. They had built log containers around the oil springs, if you will. And so the logs are preserved by the oil in such a fashion. They're able to get some very impressive and very old carbon 14 dating off these logs around first century BC, in fact. So they've been there a very long time, and someone was harvesting that sweet green crude for some purpose. And Tom theorized or hypothesized more accurately that Romans had brought their amphorae over full of wine to trade for the oil and then filled the amphorae with the oil to take it home. And that may be the number, it could have been used as an emollient, it could have been used as a fuel, could have been used as Greek fire, who knows what all it could have been. But we know that the Romans were capable of refining oil into various things, not to the level of sophistication we have today, but they did it nonetheless. And where Chris is going with that is, could those cocoa vessels have been used for a similar purpose?
Well, I mean, if you're going to go to hundreds of miles to deliver chocolate, which had high value, you were going to get something in exchange for it. Now, I think I read maybe it was grain or something. Maybe it was loaves of corn or some other grains or furs. But then again, oil would probably have medicinal purposes. So, yeah, it would be a high-value cargo. So when you go home, you had to have high-value cargoes.
Okay. Right. Might help explain the dearth of only 36 known vessels of this type.
Another thing that the American landmass, North American landmass had that they did not have in Mayan territory, the mother city regions, was they did not have masses and masses of buffalo. Now, one thing that we see in Luo is that they are bringing in something in a way that explains an extreme lack in Cahokia. And this extreme lack in Cahokia is they don't find any buffalo bones. And anybody who goes hunting understands why there's no bones. You don't haul what you don't have to haul, especially if you don't have refrigeration.
Right.
In Luo, they talk about them coming in with dried meat. And you would be able to put one canoe with a whole bunch of buffalo, many tons of meat. You didn't bring the bones because you didn't need the bones. You only brought maybe a shoulder blade that you could use as a hoe, or the horns that you would use for a buffalo headdress or the hide. But these are not things that would last. but they talk. I wrote a cooking column, and I grew up with a grandma who made hominy. And there are sections in there where they talk about making hominy, which is the first step in making cornmeal. And they talk about making pemmican, and they talk about it in such detail that you could use it as a recipe book. And so if they were sending dried cornmeal and pemmican and dried meat south to these areas where they didn't have these major meat sources or arable land to grow the corn in, that would have been worth more than gold. It would have been worth that cacao that was being transported up, because they had what the Mayan mother regions did not. Like I said, that constantly, like the Nile River Valley, that constantly renewed land by the yearly flooding, where you had the new layer of silt and so forth, extreme rich. You go around here, if you're in bottomland, the ground is black.
Yep.
That's where you want to grow stuff. And they were growing the stuff that the Mayans had to work centuries to build dirt to grow. And they were doing it like that.
Yeah. Well, most of this pre-Columbian archaeology community, if you will, you know, us crazy people, we're high on the copper coming out of the Upper Michigan and Isle Royale being the main commodity. And I guess my contention is you can't do one without all the others. So, yeah, it was a valuable commodity, and it was a unique commodity in that regard. But as you mentioned, the bison, the deer, feathers from birds that don't appear in Central and South America.
And the
medicines
that occur there that don't occur here.
Right. And we find some examples of that. For instance, and cultural export too. There have been a small number, three or four that I'm aware of, artifacts that seem to portray the hero brothers of Mayan culture.
Yes.
But they're found in Arkansas, Missouri, and Illinois. So that's a pretty good indicator, in my opinion.
One of the mounds in Cahokia has two temples. So you got that.
Yep. Yeah, and that's another example. Even though they didn't build it with stone, or at least not all stone, like they did further south, because, well, you have to go down quite a ways to get limestone. Yeah, they had plenty of dirt. They just didn't have a lot of stone. But that also brings up about the monk's mound at Cahokia and Vince Burroughs, again, when they did the quote-unquote restructuring or trying to save the sloughing off of the big mound, they used a giant excavator to do that, and Vince took pictures of many layers of different colors of clay that make up the outside of Monk's Mound, and you can extrapolate from that that it was all hauled in from somewhere else, because none of the clay at Cahokia has those colors. And well, where did it all come from?
Water transport. You look at southern Missouri, you have, and other areas, you have some very vividly red iron clay.
Yes.
People would have supplied it as part of their tribute would be, they would have brought some of their supplies with them to build.
Well, then extending that, we extrapolate how many people did it take to do that, because there was nothing growing in between those layers. It was all laid down fast, essentially at once, one season at most. So Vince did a whole lot of calculation on how many people that would take, and it was a population in excess of 500,000 people.
Well, let's
to
talk
do that
teeth.
In a single season. Okay. Let's talk what? Teeth?
Let's talk teeth.
Okay.
Teeth. The isotope content of teeth has been used repeatedly to show where somebody grew up as their teeth were forming. And some of the studies done on the Cahokians show that there was a lot of import of people from other places. So they were coming in. And we totally underestimate the numbers in Cahokia. Corn culture, steady amounts of meat. You know, you milk the deer, you have tamed fowl, you know, ducks, turkey, etc. I mean, you had the oomph to support a population of that size. And we have done so much stripping away of evidence. And if you look at early records in most areas, the population was that big.
Okay, that another point, because they have found, they've been excavating in East St. Louis, which is south of Cahokia. And it turns out there was a city there about the size of Cahokia. Basically, the entire east side of the Mississippi River, there was just one city that just extended down the river for a very long
period. Have you ever?
Same thing on the Missouri side and up the Merrimack River, and especially up Big River. There's heavy population.
Have you ever driven from San Francisco to San Diego?
Oh, unfortunately, I went the other way, but yes.
But you know what I mean? It was like that. You had city by city by city where at, like in England, you go from one place and you're 10 feet down the street and you're in the next town. But there was such a, it was a huge metropolitan area where you had city, cheek and jowl with the next city. And they had the agricultural technology to do it, to support it.
Yeah. Yes. They had other technologies too, but the one that feeds people is the agricultural.
That's the one that funds everything else. If you can feed them, you can do the other stuff.
Yep. And if you have the transportation to get it there, and if you have a messaging system to send a message and say, this is what we need, which they did. When you get into Maya country, and this is a very interesting thing, it's just now becoming an area of study for academics, and that is how the cities were laid out with regard to one another. And they are primarily on about a 10-mile grid, 10 miles, 10 miles, 10 miles, 10 miles, which happens to be the practical limit of line of sight communications in that atmospheric environment. And each and every city had its quote unquote observatory. It's like, oh yeah, they knew how to watch the stars. Yes, they did, but that's not why they had the observatories. That's my opinion only. But the Chinese had a very similar system. They just had a different language and a different numerical system.
So you're saying that you had communication down the line at a distance by communicating by fire or mirror from one hill to the next.
Right. And it was near mm-hmm. real time.
Yeah. Well, smoke signals are not just a joke in a cowboy movie.
Yeah. No, they're not. But they're not the fastest way to do it either. Smoke signals are a very slow relay version. But reflected sunlight, you could do about 20 characters a minute.
Flash, flash. Well, yeah. Same difference, but yeah. Mm-hmm. Easier to break up into individual pulses in the smoke.
Right. Yeah, it becomes not exactly binary, but it's numerical, to say the least, which is why the Romans, who used such a system, had their written alphabet. The characters of their written alphabet also represented numerals. So they didn't have to do something different. They just had to signal this will be a numeral this time. And we have a written account of their use of that at Carthage. So,
anyway. Minds think alike.
Yeah, pretty much.
Very good.
Similar problems, simple, same solutions.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Go ahead, Chris.
Okay, so just one or two last things, and then we'll continue this part three at another time soon. So, is DNA right now proving Asiatic presence in the Americas before Columbus, or will it soon prove that?
Okay, now there's several lines of evidence. There's a there's Donald Yates wrote an article on it on something called, what was it, part two of the war. Anyway, he had found DNA evidence of the Chinese on the West Coast in a particular Indian population. He said it was scattered throughout the country, but mainly it was on the West Coast in a particular area. And he said, I'm forced to conclude that there was a recent, what was it, a late medieval edition of Chinese DNA to the Native American population. So that is DNA proof that the Chinese were here before Columbus. There have been at least two different studies of horse DNA, where they look at you're smiling. They're looking at Indian ponies on the West Coast, some of the older
and in the northwestern place.
Some of the Indian ponies there, and there is Mongol pony DNA from Asia that is in them. So they probably did not have a Spanish origin. So one of two things: either the Chinese brought them over, or the horse never went extinct in America. But the book said that the Chinese cavalry went up the Missouri River and went up that way. So that's very possible. It is, in fact, just a late edition of Chinese Mongol pony DNA. The theory about the Spanish horses, well, they came from DeSoto. DeSoto had roughly 100 horses. Only two of them were mares. And most of his horses were killed by Indians, or they were eaten because they were starving or something. So basically, somehow these two mares, which probably did not survive to begin with, somehow within a few decades became millions of horses all over the country, including the West Coast and the East Coast.
Yep.
And that's impossible. That's not
same way with hogs.
Peach trees.
Oh yeah, we're still trying to figure that. There is but that's not DNA. That's just something in the wrong
place. That's okay, Mark. Go with it.
That book. Closer to home, though, you know, we did a DNA test on a very detailed one at our oldest daughter. And she, of course, you know, we know she's part Indian on both sides of the family from all four grandparents, but she's got DNA markers from the Nanjing, China area and Malaysia, which is where the Chinese base was.
Now, and we can name the specific Mongol clans that she has ancestry from through the DNA. And what cracks me up is I'm part Blackfoot, and our ponies are some of those horses that are Chinese ponies. And if you look at, as I always say, if you watch a Cowboy and Indian movie up in that part of the country, and you watch a movie about Genghis Khan, if nobody's talking, you're going to have a hard time telling them the horsemen apart because of their style of warfare and riding. Is just the same, almost down to the clothing is the same. And just the way they were the horse lords of the plains. And it's the amount of DNA that I have is so massive that my daughter has and that I have, that when I go to China, I'm greeted as a daughter of the fleet. In my records from Luo, they talk about I know the commander that went up there, whose men became my ancestors, who went up that river, that extremely muddy river, and were warned, don't dawdle. Apparently they dawdled.
it's the DNA now that is being done that is proving multiple migrations into the Americas, not just the Bering Strait. And that's going to be known to everybody whenever that is. So,
well, when you see the boats, it's duh.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's just crazy that they would have, you know, been along the shore on boats hunting seal and kelp and everything else. It's just crazy. They would have had to have been walking. You know, I have all these pre-Columbian pieces and these little heads. And somebody looks at them, they're like, oh my gosh, those look Asian, you know? And then you look at the other ones and somebody's like, oh my gosh, those look like people from the Mideast. You know, it's like, it's just, it's in these little faces. Obviously the Jomon pottery down in Ecuador, right? With Asiatic, Japanese, all the many voyages.
The intestinal flora. Where they found intestinal parasites that in mummies that were the same intestinal parasites they found in burials in Japan. I mean, DNA, yes. DNA, the critter's DNA matched, let alone the people's.
Very good. So go ahead, Rick.
So the people that had that flora who died in Egypt and were buried there had eaten something from the Far East at the very least.
Yes.
If not visited, they at least ate food.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, very good. And then all of the previous explorers before Zheng He and before these 1400s expeditions from Asia, we'll kind of get into that next time. And then we're also going to talk about Zheng He, who is this hero. When I was in Singapore, huge building, huge sculptures. This is a hero of, you know, the region. And we haven't talked much about the level of respect that he's a very exciting guy that we're going to talk about. So, you know,
I literally know somebody who says, I pray to him and he answers my prayers.
Wow. Well, I like that. I'm going to try that.
Upset being that he was Muslim, he would have found that a little uncomfortable, but she does.
I like that. I'm going to try that. You know, the California condor being brought back to, you know, these emperors, and we'll get into more of the, you know, just the time period of the Ming and the Taoists and the Buddhists and kind of some conflicts there as to why this smallpox would have happened either intentionally or accidentally. So talking about the Torquatum, which is Jim Shears has referenced you guys and just thinks your work is just tremendous. The story with Zheng He going to the Vatican and perhaps trying to share this knowledge of navigation and this device, you know, kind of being shut down type thing, but.
Yeah, well, I don't think that he specifically was one of the ones going to the Vatican, but I can tell you who did from the expedition. I believe that when they were there, it was during the time period he was on Hajj. But I can name specific leaders and senior priests who were at the Vatican when they all got scooped up by the papal legate and taken there.
And so Jim goes with that they were trying to perhaps share this Torquatum, you know, this device for longitude, latitude. And, yes. You know, they basically squashed it or, you know, didn't want to say that, you know, Asiatic cultures were so intelligent and actually taught us how to do this thing. So several hundred years later is when finally, you know, who was it, Rick, that would have invented the device, but it was around a lot before.
Well, various stages of the device have been around for thousands of years, but a full-blown sextant came along in the early 18th century.
So that 400-year span of they could have had this device known to the world, and perhaps China wanted this device to be known to the world. Maybe not, but Jim thinks that they did, and it was shut down basically, you know, who knows if that's true or not. So final thoughts, you guys, for today.
Control is power. If you can control the flow of information, if you can control access to navigational charts, you have power because you're going to have the gold or other trade goods that access that others do not have to get to those resources. And so you see a few generations of popes later, his best buddies, the Spaniards and the Portuguese, being given that because he knew they were the most likely to feed back to him what he wanted, meaning the Pope, which is temporal power and gold. And trade goods. He had to control that conduit. And even to this day, they try to control that conduit of knowledge because now knowledge is the ultimate power.
Control and, the narrative.
Yeah. And that knowledge, the narrative, that's the power. And you see people squelching anything that disagrees with their control of the flow. And the direction in which that knowledge, that narrative flows. And we're still trapped in this Victorian / manifest destiny mentality that says, we got there because we were the hottest, we were the hottest to trot down the block, instead of saying, well, we got there and there were interesting people. we have to have a reason why squishing the other guy is okay, instead of let's cooperate and share and both get bigger. It's we get bigger and you serve. We still see this today in a lot of attitudes in too many groups. And it makes me crazy because history keeps repeating itself.
If you go against the narrative, even today, right now, and it is frightening to go against the narrative. And in the information age, which is, I think, what we're in, doing podcasts like this, and it's you can't keep everybody quiet. So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. My last comment would be, when they did things, when the Chinese did things in the past, is just beware of unintended consequences, because what they intended to do and what actually happened are just about polar opposites. They intended to be the world power, the Emperor Xuandi did, and they ended up doing exactly the opposite and withdrawing from the world stage for several hundred years.
The easy route, the fast route, is often like putting your motorcycle helmet on backwards. You cut down on the wind in your eyes, but you can't see where you're going. And when you hit 90 miles an hour, you don't want to hit a wall. And you will hit that wall because you're not looking down the road where you're going.
Okay, now, guys, I need to leave soon.
Thank you, guys. Good job. We'll continue this. Rick, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Lori. Thanks, indeed. Mark.
Okay.
Good job.
Bye, guys.
Okay, bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Come on, bro.